Hello, everybody. Welcome to Lecture 4. This is on Chapter 3, Economics and the Revolt Against Reason. We're hoping that today the sound will be a little better than before. I got an extra mic that I'm using. I do want to raise the possibility, though, that people who've complained about the sound, that the problem really isn't the sound, but it's just but a horrible speaking voice I have. I was reading on Amazon today, I gave a series of lectures on history of political thought in 2007, and the Mises Institute issued that, I guess, as a set of recordings you can order. And someone had, one person given this a rating, so he said that there's a lot of good information, but the presentation's almost unbearable. So maybe those who were complaining that the sound quality isn't so good it's just my speaking voice. But anyway, I've got a new mic, so we're hoping this will help. It can't hurt. Maybe it can, but I don't think so. Now, one of the themes that comes out in human action, this is present throughout the whole book, and comes out very much in Chapter 3, which we're considering today, is that when Mises wrote Human Action, he had a very pessimistic outlook on things. He wasn't someone who was saying, well, look how great the free market is, so people are going to apply the free market and then everything will be wonderful, everybody will enjoy peace and prosperity forever, everything's going to be great. He was actually very downcast about things. He thought that economics had shown the way to peace and prosperity. Remember, we asked, how does economics do that if economics doesn't make any value judgments? Well, economics doesn't make any value judgments, but given value judgments that nearly everybody has, such as that peace and prosperity are desirable, economics can tell you how to achieve that, namely through the free market. So the problem that Mises was writing about that interested him, was that even though economics had shown the way to peace and prosperity, the world had rejected these teachings. Countries in the world were not freeing up the market, getting a complete free market. Remember, Mises was writing right after the catastrophes of World War II. World War II, had all the destruction and all the Nazi atrocities, the fighting on the Russian front between Germany and Russia, unimaginable. Number of people killed, and previous there had been the Nazi rise of Nazism, fascism, and communism. So this was not a very good period for Europe, and this colored Mises' outlook when he was writing. He had a rather bleak view of things. And we see this very clearly at the end of the book. This is the way Human Action ends. He said, but if they, and he's referring to human beings, fail to take the best advantage of it, he's referring to economics, said, but if they fail to take the best advantage of it and disregard its teachings and warnings, they will not annul economics, they will stamp out society and the human race. So he's not exactly Santa Claus here. He's looking at things in a very dark way. Now, I haven't done this, but sometimes I threaten that I would, in the oral exam that we have at Mises U, when a lot of people take it, because there's a big cash prize if you win the exam, so a lot of people try to win it. One question I wanted to ask people is, what is the last word in human action? And the answer is race. But I haven't actually done that. Well, I got that from my greatest teacher, Walter Starkey, had gone to school at Trinity College, Dublin. I think he graduated around 1970. And he told me that on the final exam, one of the professors there had asked him, what is the last word in the Ars Poetica of Horace, a great classical work, and he got the right answer to that. So that gave me the idea that maybe I could ask, what's the last word in human action? But that's just a digression, don't mind me. Now, Mises then said, well, economics has this very clear teaching that if you want peace and prosperity, then the way to achieve it is through the free market. But people nevertheless reject the teachings of economics. It seems at first surprising. It's as if someone said, well, you can be healthy if you take, you can be free of disease if you take these pills, and then people wouldn't take them. It would be rather odd, or it would be something like, say, when they developed the vaccine against polio in the 1950s, if people would say, well, I don't want to take this vaccine, why would anyone want to act like that? And Mises said the rejection of economics, rejection of teaching of economics, is part of a revolt against reason. That there were movements that said, instead of trying to solve our social problems by figuring things out rationally, really reason was very limited in what it could do, and we should, in fact, in the phrase of the great British writer D.H. Lawrence, think with blood. That would be an example of a revolt against reason. And when Mises was writing, that movements that downplayed reason were very popular. And he had in mind, when he's talking about revolt against reason, he had in mind primarily Nazism and communism. Remember, the Nazis were in power in Germany. Can anybody give me, everybody should know, what were the years that the Nazis were in power in Germany? Can anybody tell me that? Yes, that's right, 1933 to 1945. Very good. And the communists had taken over in 1917, in the October Revolution. 1917 was actually, in the Western calendar, it was in November. You know, the Russian calendar was different. It was the October Revolution. They remained in power at the time Mises was writing. So the Nazis were part of the revolt against reason because they treated reason as relative to race. They would say, well, there's an Aryan way of thinking, a Jewish way of thinking. It isn't that there's some universal reason that applies to everybody. And the communists said, no, reason is not relative to race, but it's relative to class. There's a proletarian reason, bourgeois reason. So see, both of these are treated by Mises as examples of a revolt against reason because they attack the view that there's some universal reason that holds for everybody. So in Mises' view, it isn't just true for people like him or people of his social background, the free market works better than any alternative system. This is true just universally. There isn't a separate reason for classes or races. Now, Thomas Miller asked an interesting question. How does one reason that there are reasons per class or race? Can you assume there's an underlying logic to reason this is true? That's a very interesting question. The idea would be, well, somebody said, here's some argument that reason, say, is relative to class. You would ask the person, is what you're saying relative just to your class, or do you claim it's universally true? So that would be kind of a way of putting pressure on the person, but the person might reply, well, okay, what I say is relative to class. You could get out of it that way. Or he could say something perhaps inconsistently that his view is universally true. And as we'll see, you've anticipated my next slide. Marx took that line. He said what he said was universally true. And we'll see how he tried to negotiate that view, to say reasons relative to class, but nevertheless, what he says is universally true. Now, Mises asks, why has there been a revolt against reason? Why is it that people are rejecting the view that there's a reason just applies universally? Why are they saying maybe reason is relative to social class or to race? Why do people adopt such a view? Why are they revolting? He suggests one possibility is that some people, the people who favor, say, there's a universal reason, have overestimated the power of reason. So this has led to an attack on it. So he suggested, this isn't a view he himself adopts. He said maybe you would say there's a revolt against reason because some people are saying ascribe too much to reason. So then there's been a reaction against it. And it's interesting here that Mises' attitude toward metaphysics comes out in what he says about this. He says, well, there are people who overestimate what reason can do. He said there's some people who assume just by reasoning we could come up with the truth about the universe sort of in a way that goes beyond what the science has come up with. And he has, I thought, a very funny phrase. He said there are philosophers who expatiated, meaning talked to Len, who expatiated on the absolute as if it were their pocket watch. So you can see Mises takes a dim view of metaphysics. He doesn't like these vast speculative schemes of saying how the world operates. He's very suspicious of that. And in this respect, he resembles the group that was one of his chief enemies, namely the logical positivists. They didn't like metaphysics either, at least they thought metaphysics was meaningless. Now, Mises doesn't say metaphysics is meaningless, but he's very doubtful that you can attain truth about the universe just by reasoning about it. So I think it's not central to human action. You could take a different view of metaphysics if you want and still accept the main teachings of human action. But I just mentioned it because it is, I think, important to see Mises' attitude, and this is what he says. And he's also opposed to absolute values in ethics. He seems very critical of philosophy to say, well, there's certain objective requirements that hold for all beings in the universe, that in his, in Mises' view, and that we won't be getting in this too much in this course, but it's come up in other courses, Mises takes ethics really is how we achieve social cooperation, takes it in a very human way. He doesn't like appeals to absolute value. So he says, again, one possibility of a revolt against reason is maybe there are philosophers who've gone on too much about what reason can do. They've overestimated reason, so people react against it. And he also mentions Hegel and Auguste Comte as people who were overconfident in the power of reason. Hegel was the great German philosopher. Mises says he was a very insightful thinker, but he thought he knew which way, what do you call it, the absolute mind was progressing. And similarly, Auguste Comte, the French founder of sociology, Mises, I think it's evident, doesn't think too highly of Comte because he said he was insane in the clinical sense. That isn't to take it too much of a recommendation of Comte. So he also thought he knew which direction history was going. So Mises said there are people who overestimate what reason can do, but he doesn't think this can be the correct explanation for the revolt against reason. So it's not because of these philosophers that there's been a revolt against reason, where people are saying, well, these people have made these very large claims for reason, so they've gone too far, so maybe reason isn't all that great. And Mises, well, this isn't the correct explanation, because a lot of defenders of reason, such as David Hume, the great empiricist philosopher of the 18th century, and the utilitarians and the British classical economists, who were strong supporters of reason, they were aware of reason's limits. So Hume, for example, was very critical of metaphysics. He thought that unless you could show that how concepts derive from sense impressions, you really hadn't given any clear meaning to them. There's actually a view that's influenced, I think, the objectivists. They don't like Hume much, but their view of concepts is very Humean. So Mises says, well, look, people who advocate reason, who are very pro-reason, are aware of reason's limits. So the revolt against reason can't be ascribed to people who favor reason giving too much power to it. So I think somebody that Mill was, yes, Mill, John Stuart Mill was one of, and also his was one of the great utilitarian philosophers, and his father, James Mill, was also a leading utilitarian. They were among the main utilitarians. What, according to Mises, the revolt against reason, the real source was the Marxist response to the British economists. So it's really the socialists, according to Mises, the Marxist socialists, who we have principally to ascribe blame for the revolt against reason. And why did the Marxists revolt against reason? Well, Mises said the economists were able to demonstrate what was wrong with all the socialist plans that had been proposed up till then. There were a lot of so-called utopian socialists like Saint-Simon, Cabet, other Robert Owen, various people who come up with all sorts of plans to reorganize society. The economists, British classical economists, showed what was wrong with them. Now, Mises says the economists couldn't come up with a proof that socialism in principle was impossible because it didn't have an adequate theory of value. It was not until a subjective theory of value developed that economists were able to show that socialism was in principle unrealizable because you can't have economic calculation under socialism. And of course, it was Mises himself who was the person who did that in a famous paper, Economic Calculation of the Socialist Commonwealth, which came out in 1920. But even though the economists couldn't show that socialism is in principle unrealizable, they were able to demonstrate what was wrong with all the socialist plans that people had come up with. So what is Marx going to do if the economists are saying, look, so you're a socialist, but socialism won't work? Well, one thing Marx did was he just didn't come up with his own plan of what would happen under socialism. He was very vague about it. But another thing he did was he said, well, look, these economists are coming up with arguments against socialism, but what they're saying is just based on the interests of their own class. So it isn't they've come up with some universal proof against socialist plan. They're just expressing their own class interests. So Marx was saying reason is relative to class just as a way, because he wanted to counter what the economists were saying about socialism. So he just, instead of saying, I don't like what they're saying, he said, thought in general is relative to class. So in that way, he was coming up with a general thesis that would enable him to dismiss what the economists were saying critically about socialism. Now, there's a difficulty for Marx's view, and this was the one that, it's a very good point, it was raised in the chat by Tom Miller, is suppose you say, as Marx did, that thought is determined by class interest. So then, isn't proletarian or working class, that proletariat word comes from a term that was used for the kind of the poor people in the Roman Empire, the working people, we call the proletariat. So isn't proletarian thought also determined by its class interest? But if that's right, if thought is the proletarian thought is determined by class interest, how can we say it's true? Now, as I said, one answer would be say, well, it isn't true universally because there's no such thing. It's just true from the point of view of the proletariat. But Marx didn't go that way. He said, no, his view is true. So he wants to say both thought is relative to economic class, but nevertheless, so proletarian thought is true absolutely. And why do you say that? He said, well, the interests of the proletariat reflect accurately the way history was going. So it's in the interest of the proletariat to come up with the truth, and other classes have an interest in concealing the truth. So thought is relative to class, economic class, but nevertheless, proletarian thought is true. I think you could see there's some tension in those two views, but nevertheless, that's what Marx held. Now, there's an interesting feature here. If you know Marx's background, he himself wasn't from a working class background. So he said, well, he's representing proletarian thought, but he's not from the proletariat himself. He was from a fairly well-off family, and he married, his wife was from an aristocratic family, Jenny von Westphalen. She was from an aristocratic family. And in fact, Marx's brother-in-law was the Prussian Minister of the Interior. So Marx was not a working class, from a working class background at all. Neither was his great collaborator, Friedrich Engels, who was the son of a very well-off industrialist. So they were writing, they're supposed to be expressing proletarian thought, but they're not proletarians themselves. So what Marx said in answer to that was that certain thinkers from other classes could go over to the proletariat. So you didn't have to always, it wasn't true for everybody, say in a particular class, that person would represent the interests of his or her class, but sometimes you could go over to a different class. And Marx said there's some intellectuals, such as himself, who've gone over to the proletariat. Now, I want to give some examples of this Marxist view that thought is relative to the economic class. Mises gives it. Again, at the time Mises was writing, Marxist approaches to history of science were quite popular. He mentions in his footnote Lancelot Hogben, who was a British writer. There are others similar who wrote along the same line. J.D. Crowther was another name you'll see who held views of this kind of say that thought in science, you think, well, if there anything is universally true, it wouldn't have to be the physical sciences. So the Marxists said, no, what goes on in the physical sciences is relative to economic developments. For example, when Galileo studied projectile motion, remember he was studying how bodies would fall in parabolic arcs and how cannonball would fall. Why was he doing that? Well, one reason, he wasn't just, according to the Marxists, just because he was curious to find out what would happen, but he was studying ballistics because there were a lot of people who wanted better armament. So according to the Marxist view, he's developing the science of ballistics because they're people who want better armaments. Another example is the Marxist historians of science claim that when James Clerk Maxwell, the great British physicist in the 19th century, was studying electromagnetism, this is because businessmen were interested in wireless telegrams, so they needed to develop electromagnetism in order, say, they could pave the way for radio and other inventions. So in the Marxist view, the history of science is the development of science is motivated by economic interests. Now, Mises raises a fundamental criticism of this whole line of thought. Remember, the line of thought is, well, the Marxists say, thought is relative to economic class. So one, you might imagine somebody objecting, oh, but how can you say that? Because clearly in the physical sciences, we have things that are universally true. And the Marxist response is, well, no, even the physical sciences develop in response to economic interests. So, as I say, Mises raises a basic criticism of this line of thought. He says, supposing that view is true, and he's not saying it is true, but he says, supposing it is true that scientific discoveries serve the interests of particular classes. So supposing it's right, say, that Maxwell worked on electromagnetism because there were people who wanted to develop wireless telegraphy. Well, why would it be in the interests of a class to come up with a false theory? Wouldn't, if they have if they want to have a wireless telegraph, wouldn't they want it to be based on a true theory? Because otherwise, they're not going to get what they want. So even if scientific discoveries do come about because they're serving economic interests, that doesn't disprove the universality of reason, because people could get these, serve their interests just by developing true theories. Now, Mises then extends the point by saying, if you want to find out whether a theory is true, you can't do so by referring to the interests or motives of those who support it. So Marx very often did that. He would say, well, these economists are favoring the free market because they're really just lackeys of the bourgeois. They've been paid off. But if that were true, we would still have to evaluate these theories on their own. We see this kind of the same kind of thing today. Say there's some people, you know, as you know, there's a big controversy about global warming and climate change. So some people say, well, the scientists who are skeptical about global warming are in the pay of the oil companies or in the pay of various groups that give them money to attack global warming view. Now, even if that were right, that wouldn't show something's wrong with their arguments. If you want to find out if an argument is true or a theory is true, you have to evaluate the theory directly. It isn't enough just to point out the economic interests or motives of those who support it or those who oppose it. Now, we might ask an interesting question here. Is Mises violating his own rule here? Because remember, what he's saying is, if you want to know if a theory is true, you can't do that just by saying people had certain motives to support it. But he's saying himself, well, why did Marx have this view that reason is relative to economic class? He says, well, this is because this enabled him to avoid answering the criticisms of the economists, British economists, are directed against socialism. So you might say, well, isn't Mises violating his own rule because he's trying to attack the Marxists by showing the motives for their thought, but he just said you can't really show a theory's wrong just by showing what the motives people have for going against it. But I don't think this would be a correct claim to bring against Mises, because his refutation of Marxism isn't based on his account of Marx's motives. He has arguments that go directly against what Marx is saying, but given that he's refuted Marx to come up with arguments against him, he still thinks an interesting question to ask: what were the motives Marx had in advancing his theory? Now, Mises makes some quite detailed criticisms of the Marxist theory. Remember, the Marxist theory is reason is relative to class interest. So there's a bourgeois reason, a proletarian reason, maybe an aristocratic reason, and so on. I can't help thinking, you know, I have when I was using this mic, there's a famous sentence in Marx's book of 1858, Contributions to the Critique of Political Economy, where he says something like, the handmill gives you slavery, the watermill gives you feudalism. I wonder what Marx would say the hand might gives you, what social system he would think that gives you. But now, to return from my attempted humor, Marx is saying that each class has a clear interest. So say it's in the interest of the working class to promote socialism, be in the interest of the capitalists to defend capitalism, and so on. But meaning that, is that true? And there, in fact, there are often conflicts about the appropriate policy for a class. For example, some business people favor and the government intervene in the economy to help them. Others say no, the government should stay out of the economy. Some workers say they should support labor unions. Some workers don't want to be in labor unions. So how do we know what's supposed to be the appropriate policy for a class? And there isn't a method of identifying the interest of a class other than what a particular writer favors. So Marx himself was a socialist, so he would consider only those who favor his policies reflecting the true interests of the working class. But supposing there were workers who said, no, we think we do better in the free market than under your system, he would just say, well, they're not reflecting the true interests of the proletariat, but he really doesn't have any way of showing that. I mean, if workers said that, they would be workers just as much as the socialist workers. So it isn't at all clear that there's a one class interest. There are many conflicting views about what the class interest is. Now there's some additional problems that Mises raises about the Marxist class theory. The one we just raised is that there isn't an objectively identifiable policy that's in a class interest. So if you said, well, the capitalists are interested in promoting their interest. We could ask, well, what is their interest here? The workers are trying to promote the workers' interest. It isn't, in general, clear what policy that would lead to. But putting that aside, supposing we could say there is some policy that's in the interest of the class as a whole, there's still conflicts among members of the same class. And I gave some examples of that already, such as conflicts between unionized workers or non-unionized workers and supporters of government aid to particular industry versus everybody else. So here, the point's a little different. The earlier point was people might favor certain policies because they think they're in the interest of the whole class, but they just have different views on what's in the interest of the whole class. Somebody might say, well, it's best for workers as a whole if workers are unionized. And other people might say, no, that's not right. That's not right. Workers as a whole are better off without labor unions. Now, this point is, whether or not there's some policy that's best for workers as a whole, there's still conflict among particular groups of workers. Say, unionized workers wouldn't have to say unions are better for all workers, but they'd say they're better for our group. So there are conflicts among intra-class conflicts within a particular class, not just it isn't that we find there's a united front where everybody in the workers favors what will help the whole working class. What about conflicts among groups of workers or conflicts between groups of capitalists? Now, there's an additional difficulty for the Marxist account of class. And you can see this one, it's really an extension of the point I just made. Remember, the point I just made was, even if you thought there's a single policy that's best for the whole class, and I question that because what if you have different views on what's best for a whole class? But supposing everybody agreed a certain policy would be best for the whole class, what if that policy might not be best for every group within the class? So we could have, what about conflicts among groups in the class? So we could extend the point, well, why should an individual, a particular person, support your class interest, even on the assumption there's a single interest for your class? So supposing you think, say, it would be best for workers to join unions, that would be best for all the workers as a class, but maybe it wouldn't be right for you. Why should you follow what is good for your class? Why shouldn't you just consider what's in your own interest? Now, Mises' comment where he drew attention, has very often happened. Mises anticipated further work, and he's really anticipating what we call a public choice argument was given, say, but later by the philosopher Alan Buchanan in his book Marx and Justice, and also Gordon Tullock in his book The Social Dilemma. And what they said was something like, suppose there's some policy that's good for a whole group or class, a particular individual isn't going to be able to do much to help that policy just by supporting it himself. So the individual it would be rational for the individual just to act in whatever he thinks his own interest is, even if he thinks some policy would be best for the whole class. What he does isn't going to be able to contribute much to what works for the whole class, so he should just do what's best for him or her. It would be something like, it's an argument sometimes given against voting, something like, suppose you're very strongly convinced that one of the candidates, Obama or Romney, is much better than the other, but your vote isn't going to be able to do much to get your candidate to win. So the argument is, well, why bother to vote, given that voting involves some trouble? This is kind of a similar, structurally similar argument, saying, look, even if you think some policy is best for your class, your supporting it isn't going to do much, since you're just one person in the whole group, so you should just support what's in your own interest. So whether that's right or not, the point here is that Marx hasn't shown that if something is in your class interest, that gives you a reason, overriding reason, to do that thing. Now, in attacking the Marxist view of class, Mises gives some examples, and I think one example he gives is especially important when he's trying to show what's wrong with this class interest view, the view that what people think or what they do is determined by their class interest. Now, one claim is very popular. Friedrich List, who was a 19th century German economist, made this claim, is that Britain supported free trade only when its industries could dominate others. And then when Britain was faced with rivalry from other countries like Germany and the United States, then they shifted to protection. So the claim here would be that free trade isn't supported because economists show that policy is beneficial, but it's just supported because it was in the interests of Britain to support it at one time, because under free trade, at least at one period, the British would be able to outcompete other people. So when that stopped being true, then they stopped supporting free trade. So Mises raised what I think is a very interesting point against this. He said, well, supposing you're going to claim that protection, say having tariffs, will help particular businesses. So someone says, well, the businessmen are supporting tariffs because that's in their economic interest. He says, well, that's true when you're first putting in the tariff, when you're, suppose you start with free trade and then you put in a tariff. So some people are going to benefit. They're going to get extra profits because now they have protective tariffs, so they're going to be able to make more money. But what's going to happen if they get those profits, then other people will move into that industry and profits will go down to the average rate. The average rate of return is the same for all businesses. So business will adjust either to high or low tariffs. It won't be the case that companies are able to earn permanently above the going rate of return as long as there's freedom of entry into that industry. Other people will come in and just drive their profits down to the average. So because of that fact that you won't be able to benefit in the long run through some measure, you could just benefit when the measure is being put in, but then businesses will adjust to that. This limits how much interest theories can be used to explain things because people will adjust to whatever the policies are and they'll just still earn a common rate of return. Now, Mises has devoted most of the lecture to criticizing the Marxist view that reason is relative to class. But Mises also considers racial theories. Remember, the racial theory would say reason is relative to race. So the Nazis would say, well, there's Jewish physics or Aryan physics. So instead of saying there's proletarian logic and bourgeois logic, they would have it with different races. So we can apply criticisms like the ones advanced that we just gave against the Marxist class theory to these racial theories as well. Remember, one of the criticisms was, we say that thought is determined by class interests. One of the criticisms was, well, what is the class interest of a particular group? There are different views on that. We can make the same view of criticism of racial theories. You say thought is relative to race. Well, what is the interest of a particular group or race? What about conflicts among people and what's in the interest of a particular group? And what about, say, conflicts among groups or individuals or in the same race? So, you see, you can take the same criticism that Mises gave against the Marxist view. Remember, he calls these views polylogist views. They're saying there are many logics instead of one logic. So he says you just take the same criticisms and apply them to the racial theories. Now, Mises also raises some additional points about the racial theories, about this theory called racial polylogism. And one is that some people take this view. They say, well, those people, say, live in the Western world, the United States, Western Europe, will think that progress in economic progress or scientific progress is better in some way than, say, living in less prosperous or, to use a loaded word, primitive conditions. But some people say, well, this just reflects Western values, say maybe from the point of view of certain other cultures, the way they're doing things is just as valid or just as good as the way we do it. Maybe they just don't value progress in scientific inventions very much. Mises is very critical of that. He suggests all cultures aim at material progress. So he isn't saying he's applying his own particular standard. He likes progress and scientific invention. So he says, well, then cultures that aren't very good at progress and scientific inventions are bad because they don't reflect his standard. He says, no, in fact, all cultures aim at material progress. So the ones that haven't attained it have failed, judged by their own standards. And this is a type of reasoning Mises goes in for a lot. If you read further in Human Action, you'll see one of the basic criticisms he has of socialism and government intervention in the economy is that these measures don't work judged by the goals that the people who favor them want. So it's basic for him. He doesn't want to apply his own values, say, you're wrong because I don't like what you're doing. He's saying, no, you aren't attaining what you say you want. So he said, well, these, in fact, cultures that don't have much in the way of economic progress or scientific invention are really failing by their own standards. Now, we now get into a very controversial area. Mises asked the question, could it be the case that some of the racist claims are true? Remember, sometimes racists will say, well, the Aryan race is a superior race, all the other races are inferior. So could it be the case that some races are more capable than others of intellectual achievements? So what if the racists are right? Well, Mises said, we can't rule out a priori, remember a priori is just by thinking about it without empirical investigation, that some races are more capable than others of intellectual achievement. So we can't say, look, there's something self-contradictory about these racist claims that they're superior races. But we don't know enough to say that the racist claims are true. And supposing the racist said, well, look, such and such a group really hasn't produced very much, so how can you say that this group is equal to the great Aryan race if what have they done? So Mises says, well, how do you know that group won't produce a lot in the future? Remember here, Mises is getting back to a point we mentioned in some of the previous lectures that Mises thinks there aren't inductive laws of history. There are just too many variables. Things are just too complex to come up with inductive laws of history. So we aren't able to say that we can show that certain races aren't as intellectually capable of others. We just can't come up with evidence for that because there are too many variables. We're not in a position to say that. Now, going a little further with his criticisms of racial theories, Mises made fun of those who point to the superior achievements of their race or culture. Somebody said, well, look how great we are because, say, in the United States, we have these great inventors like Edison and we have great scientists, so look how great we are if some other country hadn't produced so much. So Mises said, well, this really reflects collectivist thinking, because remember, it's only individuals who act. Remember, what is this basic principle called where we say only individuals act? Does anybody remember that? Methodological individual. Yes, David Cranehead, that's right. So it's only individuals act. So if you say, well, look how great a particular culture, nation, or race is, and you just list various achievements by people in that group, it's particular individuals have done those things, not a group or collective. And in fact, Mises is placed great deal of stress on what he called the creative genius, or the person who really bursts the bounds of conventional thought and comes up with completely new ideas that are different from other people. He himself, I think, would be a good example of the creative genius. So for Mises, when you talk about superior achievements, it's not really appropriate to talk about what the race or culture is of the people who come up with them. What's important are the achievements of these particular individuals. So he also raises a point here. This would apply, this criticism would apply both to racial polylogism and Marxist or class polylogism. He has a more general argument against them, sort of more philosophical argument. Remember, and I lectured on this before, he thinks that everyone looks at reality with the same a priori category. Say we all have these concepts like causational laws of logic, and we couldn't conceive what it would be like for anyone to use a different logic. So we say, well, it just doesn't make sense to think there could be people around with a different logic from our own. We wouldn't be able to understand such people. Now, he supplements this with an evolutionary argument here. He says, because we have these concepts like causality, and we think in accord with them, this enables us to survive. We've got these concepts. This enables us to get along in the world. So let's imagine there were possibly human-like creatures with different categories. He thinks they would either be wiped out by natural selection, or they would revert to the level of animals operating on instinct, because he's assuming that the categories we have are the ones that will enable beings to survive, or reasoning and not depend on instincts. He thinks if there were other categories not depending on instincts, they would be wiped out, just wouldn't work. Now, so, and you can see, Mises is not exactly a fan of class or racial polylogism, but there is a version of these theories that's a little more sophisticated than the views we just considered. And this view would say, well, maybe it's true that there's some thought that's universal, so we can't have either class or racial polylogism to explain everything, but still when we're studying history, some version of either class or race theory is valid. And the way this account goes is this. They say, well, the historian always uses value judgments. He has to select what topics he wants to write about. When he's doing research, he'll pick particular topics, particular documents. And he'll have to present his material in a certain way. He'll explain things in a certain way. So the view is, well, the value judgments the historian has are influenced by race or class. So even if Mises is right, everybody's using the same logic, still we have different value judgments. And it's this that is that the race or class are affecting. So we can still kind of get some polylogist view in through the back door. So say, well, sure, there's some universal logic, maybe Marx and some of the racial theories went too far, but still you can't deny, can you, that the historian uses value judgments, and this gives us room for the some sort of polylogist views, not strictly different logics, but different value judgments at any rate. Now, what Mises doesn't accept this view. He says it's true The historian uses what he calls specific understanding. Remember, we talked about that in the lecture, I think, last week. And what the historian does here is, well, he's trying to explain someone's action, like why did Caesar cross the Rubicon River 49 BC? So he would list the various factors that, in order to explain the person's action, you have to exercise what he calls specific understanding to rate how important these factors are. There aren't fixed rules he can use to do that. He just has to use his own judgment. But, and here's a crucial point, means that this proselyte, the historian's using specific understanding, is not the same as value judgment. The historian, trying to explain, say, what motivated Caesar, that isn't his doing that, shouldn't be affected by whether he likes Caesar or not. Say, Theodore Mommsen, the great Roman historian, is a great proponent of Caesar. There have been people who hate Caesar. So they should still come up with the same explanation regardless of whether they like or dislike Caesar. So it's true, we said the historian uses specific understanding or verstehen, but doesn't follow that he has to be dependent on value judgment. And Mises also thinks that historians will agree on which factors are relevant regardless of their views or their value judgment. So in sum, Mises rejects racial and Marxist polylogism and also this more sophisticated view that says value judgments come in an historian is working, so that leaves open the door for the influence of race or class. And Mises said, no, the historian, if he's working properly, should not be influenced by his particular value judgment. Okay, so what I'm going to do now, I think I'll go to the Q&A box. You can type in your questions in the Q&A or in the chat, whichever you like. Oh wait, I didn't get, the Q&A didn't work. Is it going here? Wait. Wait, I'm clicking on the Q&A and nothing's happening. Oh, nobody put anything in yet, that's why. Okay, so we're waiting for the questions, objections, refutations. And was the sound a little better this time? Stephen says, you don't think we can all see if it's in the Q&A. Well, that's right. See, if you write in the Q&A, I read the question. You write only, I think I'm the only one who can see the in the Q&A. So you can see me, but I can't see you, but I can see the Q&A, and you can't. So that's only fair. Okay, so we have here that I can't see is I don't see this the sound. Wait, I'm not seeing that somebody says the sound. I can't see that Rod says something on the sound, but I don't see the rest of this. Something's blocking it here. Okay, I guess I can close the team view. Okay, sound is much better. Okay, great. Glad to hear it. Now you can hear me. I could still be in trouble because what if you decide you don't like what you hear? Maybe before you weren't objecting because you weren't sure what I was saying, but now you know. Reminds me of one of my jokes. You know, there was a couple that had just gotten married. And one day when they went home, they found an envelope and it had two tickets in it to a concert. It was extremely hard to get seats to this concert. So there was a little card that said, "Guess Who?" And they were very happy to get these tickets because it was very hard to get into the concert. So they went to the concert. When they got home, their entire house had been cleaned out. All the furniture had been taken away. There was nothing left. There was a little envelope on the floor, and they opened it and said, "Now you know." Well, I thought it was funny anyway, but never mind. Well, does anyone have any? Oh, good, somebody laughed. He was just saying, "Rob, you also thought the song was better." Good. Okay. Oh, now here's some questions here. Someone says, Mark asked, "How similar is Mises' theory of reading to Ayn Rand's philosophy?" Well, there are some differences. See, remember, Mises thinks that we have these a priori concepts, which are concepts you have before in order to make sense of experience. And Rand thinks that all concepts are derived from experience. So she didn't like this aspect of what Mises was saying in the objectivist view. They think that every concept means, say, something in the physical world or something, one of its properties, so they wouldn't accept a priori concept. Steve says here, Steinberg, so since Mises thinks they sort of agree on the relevant factors, he was really depending on intellectual honesty. Yes, it's a very good point. He says, there are some people who just aren't honest or not playing with a full deck, but he thinks if a historian, even a historian, holds a particular point of view, as long as he's honestly looking at the historical evidence, he should be able to come up with the same list of relevant factors as someone with a different point of view. David said, would Mises agree with John Calhoun's concept of the fiscal action government dividing society into two classes, taxpayers and tax consumers? Well, I don't see anything in Human Action that would contradict that, but I don't think he explicitly addresses that claim. It is one that Rothbard, who was a very strong Misesian, accepted and wrote about, but he didn't especially address that. It would fit in very much with a classical liberal theory of classes developed by the French classical liberals like Charles Comte, Charles Dumoyer. Ralph Rako has written on them, but it's not, I think, a topic Mises has addressed. Andrew says, "Why don't we talk a little more about praxeology? In particular, could point us to where we can find any sophisticated reputation against the a priori nature of the science?" Also, was it true that Rothbard did not accept praxeology? Well, the second part of your question, Rothbard is very strongly in favor of praxeology. I mean, he wrote on this. I remember, in fact, in the old days when Rothbard used to go to Mises University, I remember his lecture at the end, he used to say, "Carry on the fight for praxeology." Well, on attacks on a priori nature, you could divide your question really into two things. You might be asking people specifically attacked use of a priori reasoning in economics. I mean, you could mention the British economist Terence Hutchinson, who wrote criticizing a priori in economics. Mark Blaug, B-L-A-U-G, is another one. There are philosophers who criticize and don't accept the notion of the a priori. I think Michael Devitt, D-E-V-I-T-T, has some work on that. Philip Kitcher, I have to get the references for you. But, there are people who attack the notion. Now, Bob said, but historians do come up with radically different explanations, right? Oh, yes, that's certainly true, but according to Mises, if they were doing their job right, they really shouldn't. Now, Stephen says that one difference is when a historian discovers new relevant facts. Well, of course, that can change things. I mean, then I guess the point there would be is that once those facts are known, then all historians who make use of them, according to Mises, should be still be able to come up with the same explanation. Of course, you're right, if you change the historical data, then that will change the explanation. Some historians or you have materials available to them that others don't, then that would be a reason to think they won't come up with the same account of things. Now, I think while we're waiting for a question, I'll pose a problem to you. There's one well-known Austrian economist, I won't say who it is, who's supposed to have made this statement. He said, remember, Austrian economics is a value-free science, so it doesn't make apply any value judgments. So, if that's right, say, you could imagine someone who was both an Austrian economist and a Nazi, you could be completely consistent because if you're an Austrian economist, that doesn't commit you to any value judgments. So there's nothing inconsistent in someone being both an Austrian economist and a Nazi. Now, I think there is a problem in that argument. Can anybody tell me what it is? See, the argument is, well, Austrian economics is a value-free science. So then, well, somebody could be a Nazi and support Austrian economics because that might be an unusual combination, but there'd be nothing inconsistent in it. And I see while I ask you, Rob asked, do you know if any of the Nazis ever directly attack Mises' work? I'd have to really look that up. I'm sure they did. They were aware of him. They were going to have him arrested when they took over Austria in March 38. I have to actually look up whether they wrote on his views. Now, Leslie says the Nazi would say scientific ideas are determined by race. And I think you're on the right track there. See, the problem with that argument, you've given a particular example showing what's wrong with the argument, is Nazism is not just a collection of value judgments making various factual claims as well. Things about how the world works, and many of those are inconsistent with Austrian economics. So the fact that Austrian economics doesn't find value judgments perfectly right, it doesn't follow from that that it's consistent to be both an Austrian economist and a Nazi, because that would be true only if Nazis had just consisted of nothing but value judgments. Danny says, he says, conception seems to grasp the meaning of an action through discursive reasoning. Understanding seeks the meaning of action in passing intuition of a whole. Well, see, here, I think this is, there's one respect it's different, but it's basically similar to what he says in human action, because he says when you're applying specific understanding, when you're trying to get, say you have these lists of relevant factors, you're trying to state which is more important, this can only be done through some kind of intuitive process. You can't apply some kind of logical rules to do it. You have to get it through some kind of your judgment as a historian. Now, the difference is he makes a distinction in human action. He says you have in, say, aesthetics, you have kind of a feeling of empathy or fellow with the work, or you get grasped the sort of feeling, or you feel your way into the work. He says this is different from what takes place the historian is doing. So we have to see what he meant in epistemological problems, like empathic intuition. I think he wasn't, but I have to check this, he wasn't meaning just that you have to favor or sympathize with what the person is doing. I think he just means you're grasping kind of without rules what is motivating the actor given his views. I think that would be fairly consistent with human action, but there might be some difference in emphasis there. Now, Marx says, the very existence of human reason is a non-rational fact. Isn't that statement awfully weak? Isn't the task of any philosophy to establish the validity of reason itself? Well, I think the problem Mises raises there, he thinks, as far as establishing the validity of reason, he thinks you can't really do that without presupposing reason. Now, you could raise the point, well, if that's right, does that mean you can't have arguments in favor of reason? But supposing, as I'm sure you'll grant me, supposing you're right, supposing philosophers are supposed to try to establish the validity of reason, it might be difficult to do that, impossible to do that without presupposing reason. But supposing you're right, I'm sure you'll grant me, maybe you're right, there wouldn't be an objection to what Mises is saying, because Mises, in the statement you quote, is the very existence of human reason is a non-rational fact. It doesn't follow from that you can't establish that reason is valid. All that's saying is, supposing we would ask, why is it the case that there are human beings who are able to reason? Mises is saying he thinks that's not something you can show had to be the case logically, just is the case that there are such beings. So that's perfectly consistent with trying to establish the validity of reason if you think that that can be done. I think there's some question whether that can be done, but if you thought it could be, that's perfectly consistent with what Mises is saying in the statement you quote. At least I'm not seeing what the inconsistency is. Now, David Kramer says, could we say for Stein achieving the same subjective understanding of the individual understanding? Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. You're viewing what the individual is doing. You're grasping the particular value judgments he had. In fact, R.G. Collingwood, the British historian, wrote Idea of History in 1946, published after death, said that our thoughts, the historian's thought, is identical to that of the actor's history. So that's pretty much along the lines you're suggesting. Now, Bob asked, if auction economists is value-free, how can they make public policy recommendations? Well, first of all, they can have their own values. They can say, well, I want such and such, here's how you achieve them. So it's Austrian economics is value-free, doesn't follow Austrian economists are value-free. Probably they're not. Most people do. I think everybody does have certain values. Second, more important, the Austrian economists can say, if such and such are your values, here's how to achieve them. That is not a value judgment. That's a descriptive statement. That's what Mises does. He said, if you want peace and prosperity, you should do such and such, namely establish a free market. So he's not introducing, he's not making, that isn't a value judgment. That's a factual descriptive claim. You see. Yeah, so Danny has a good quotation making this point. Mises is saying there, you can't prove the validity of reason without presupposing reason valid. I mean, I guess you could have a consistency proof for reason using reason. And the paper, very interesting paper you might look at by Michael Dummett, D-U-M-M-E-T-T, very difficult paper called The Justification of Deduction, if you're interested in that question. That's a rather difficult paper, so I'm not going to go through it. I don't think I could, but if you're interested in that question, that would be a good paper to look at. Oh, here's a question down in the Q&A. Let me see here. Andrew says, what would be a strong argument against the idea of a social contract? Every discussion I have eventually arrives at this. They will argue that government's need for, or is morally right because its existence is for the common good. Well, I think there are two points. I mean, this is a very broad question, but just two points. I mean, if people are saying, has there been an actual social contract where people have agreed, say, to recognize the government, and there doesn't seem like there is one. Lysander Spooner in No Treason argued very effectively for that. If there's supposed to be social contract, who exactly has agreed to it? Who's bound by it? So there isn't a social contract. And if somebody said, well, it's a hypothetical contract, but people would agree on in certain conditions. And I always like Bob Nozick's comment, something like, they're not worth the paper they're not written on. So now on common good, well, wouldn't that just be reducible to the goods of particular individuals? It's not clear how you get a justification for government out of there. But one would have to see the specific arguments that people were raising, you know, in your discussions to have a more detailed answer. Let's see, Leslie says, aren't some historical examples of Star War One perhaps too complex to reduce to a single explanation by Verstehen? The facts can be weighed in different ways. Well, certainly, right, that, but in World War One, you have to be explaining a lot of different people. So, I mean, it wouldn't be an explanation of a particular person's action there. You'd be different, involve different people. So what Mises' claim, I think, is that historians should agree on all the relevant factors and that they shouldn't be influenced by their own value judgment. I have to think about this, that every application of Verstehen by a competent historian would come up with the same results. But that would be a matter for more individual judgment, you see. David Krim says, that a praxeologist predicts anything in the future, somebody decides to use X, as it means we know Y is the means which will actually achieve the end design, and we know the end design will not be achieved. Well, we could make that as a general statement, but remember, praxeologist isn't making claims about specific actions. So you would have the general truth that if somebody selects a means that won't achieve his ends, then he won't achieve the ends. That would certainly be right. Okay, we have a few more minutes, I think. Well, Andrew says he'd like some questions. Could I do more of those? Well, I'll try if I can think of any good questions. One I'll give you is, I don't have good answers, is why do you think Mises has such a negative attitude toward metaphysics? And that's one. I won't give you an answer to that, but maybe that's one you could think about. Again, it seems like words started by individual, not sure we always know the individual motives. But I think that's a good point. I mean, we don't always. That's a very good point you raise. Now, Stephen said he hated Kant. Well, I think he didn't like Kant's ethical views. He was quite a bit influenced by him in theory of knowledge, but he certainly didn't like his ethical views. Yeah, now, so Mises is saying if they disagree with judgments of relevance, which is African-specific understanding, then we can't have a solution that everybody accepts. So he's not making this more radical claim that everyone would have to agree on the judgment of relevance, but what they would agree on is which are the relevant factors. Now, Andrew says, would it be because you view the state of existence as an ultimate given? Well, I mean, that, I think he did think that metaphysics were trying to explain what couldn't be explained. That's a very good point. But you could ask, well, why was he so sure that these theories wouldn't get anywhere? So why would metaphysician said it's not an ultimate given. Why would he be so sure they were wrong? Okay, now here's a question. Well, David Scott, given the collectivist nature, at least Kenzie Judith doesn't mean methodological individual and say he was influenced by his religious heritage to only a very minor degree. Well, I don't know if he thinks that Judaism is collectivist, but his main comments on Judaism as a religion are in his book Socialism, and he pretty much views Judaism as a religious Judaism as kind of based on outdated legalism, and he doesn't think it has much of a future, so he's pretty critical of it, just as sort of thinks it's too legalistic, and whether that was the correct view or not, of course, is a different question, but that was his view of things. I say that's in his book, Socialism. I discussed that a bit when I gave at the Austin Scholars Conference earlier this year. I gave a lecture on Judaism and capitalism. I think you can get that on the Mises page. I discussed Mises' views in a little on that topic a little bit in that lecture. Well, okay, I guess we're out of time now. So thanks, everybody, for coming to my lecture, and I hope we'll see you for lecture 5 next week. Okay, thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.